Thanks to all three of you for terrific readings. It follows that after the variety of voices we heard and the apparitions that arrived at the reading's conclusion that I would want to begin my questions with one of lineage. So I'm just going to ask you three generally. Feel free to jump in when you see fit. What lineage do you seek to add to or challenge? And are there poets or poetries you find inspiring in the difference to your work? Go for it.
It's a simple little question.
Well, I feel like I've just answered that, having been talking about the romantics, that you can hear there's some arguments with Wordsworth going on in those poems. What is perception? How do we create our realities? And a profound relationship with Whitman, which is also a kind of ongoing consideration about being a single speck, a single bit of consciousness, and also part of a broader community. And Whitman's great fascination is where self ends and where community starts. Does self ever end? And so those are abiding questions for me, and therefore he is an abiding teacher.
How about the second part of the question? Do you feel that there are poets whose difference is instructive to you, mm-hmm. and also to Timothy and Dana, you as well? Because often I think in these kinds of questions, people talk about the poets who are clearly their mentors, or they're clearly working out a conversation with. But I think, too, one of the great aspects of contemporary American poetry is the huge variety that all of us are constantly engaging with and being excited by. And often poets don't talk about that difference.
Well, I guess in answer to the first part of the question, and sort of by way of dodging both parts of the question, if I possibly can, I'll say it's interesting what you were saying, Mark, because I feel like through, no matter what I do and what I try, even when I'm writing poems in the voice of other people, I'm essentially writing lyric poems about the self or a self. And I never get to the point of community or any kind of a public poetry or any kind of an engagement with, except in the most personal way, with great themes. But of course, Whitman contains multitudes, and he seems to be such a good mentor for thinking about the self as really the only vehicle for encountering public. So I don't find myself raising large questions explicitly, and I really admire it when people can do that. I feel like I'm sort of threading a needle. There's something in my, I don't know, I feel a little bit like I'm just sort of weaseling into somebody else's experience when I'm writing a poem in the voice of somebody else. And I guess it's an imaginative act, but it's also an act of total projection. It's maybe compassion and narcissism at the same time.
Do you feel like an heir of Dickinson more than an heir of Whitman's?
I guess in that big, great divide, yes. I think so. And I mean, just a poet I always go back to and think about constantly is Louise Glück. And I see her as much more an heir of Dickinson than Whitman. And then line length also has something to do with it, ultimately, too. My lines and my poems tend to be short, and that, in that sort of superficial but meaningful way, makes me feel more kinship with Dickinson.
I guess in my case, I grew up in Vermont when Robert Frost was still alive, and the great tradition of New England poetry represented by Frost and Emily Dickinson preeminently, but also people like Bryan and Longfellow contributed. And I think what struck me as a young writer when I started to meet other poets and got me interested in writing in metrical forms was how many different kinds of people use the forms in different ways, and I was struck that there must have been some trans-individual value to these. I think particularly, because we're in California tonight, of Tom Gunn and Edgar Bowers. You couldn't imagine two more different people, but had the same kind of passion for poetic craft, and that made a great impression on me when I was young.
I wanted to think about the second half of your question and sort of turn to Dickinson in that way as an explosive poet of intense musicality and introspection, whose poems seem generated by language itself, whereas I think of Whitman's poems as growing out of experience in some way. But for Dickinson, it's the collision between words that seems to make the poem take place. And for any of us, I think, in order to grow, what we have to do is sort of reach towards our temperamental opposite. So if I, by nature, am sort of an expansive rambler, you know, what I need to pull in is that contained, energizing music. So that would be interesting to think about how you push against what's opposite to you.
Well, talking about the sort of self and how one engages with the self and sort of following the issue of autobiography that you brought up, Dana, I wondered if you could talk about, for all three of you, how the artifice of the art allows you to contend with your own stories, and how might the imagination fit into that equation between speaker and self? Clearly, the poems you're writing are not always completely, totally about the you that exists outside of them and goes to the store and what have you, but that fits in there some way.
Well, certainly, again, speaking in terms of forms and working with forms, and this came out in things Mark and Dana will address in their readings, you find yourself looking at things differently when you write a poem. You may start out with a feeling, and the fact that you need to secure a rhyme or locate a cadence makes you shift the phrasing around and think a little bit differently about your subject. And I think one of the valuable things about writing is it has the possibility of bringing out the better self in you, the richer self, the more tolerant self, the broader-minded self, and the very fact of trying to find the best way to say something and to respond to the exigencies of something that is external to yourself and deaf to your own desires is very enriching, I think.
One of the things that seems to me so fun about writing poems is that you're allowed to be an absurd self also, which I think it's just a great privilege to be able to adopt other personae, even when still writing basically in a way grounded in one's own experience, to have an attitude toward your own experience that is not straightforward, and to be playful around subjects that, you know, in the moment of experience, you can't imagine how you could make a joke about that, or that could be something humorous. But once you start writing, there's obviously that distance, and I think it's the opportunity to be a little bit mordant about one's own experience is a large part of the reason that I write poems.
I often teach memoir workshops to students who are who identify themselves as fiction writers and as poets. And it's interesting to discover that the fiction writers often struggle terribly with who is this I who is telling the story, where the poets just have no trouble at all. So I'm creating a speaker, because that's what we do. My own sense is that a poem in some way creates a character of who is talking to us, and then that character is sometimes quite close to the biographical me, is attached to my life, and sometimes that character is much more like a subjectivity, which is also me, but the experience and the details about that character could matter less to the poem. So I think this kind of sense of elasticity about the creation of a speaking voice is one of the things that poets enjoy.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? Mark, you have also written autobiographical prose. So what is that like? Do you feel a greater obligation to be oneself when writing?
What a good question. Not really, because what happens when you write, I mean, of course, if you're writing autobiographically, you're writing about the past. And there is a distance between the person who's doing the writing and the recollecting and the shaping and the person who had the experiences. So, for instance, to look at yourself as a child is to be inside that perception and simultaneously at a remove watching that child think and feel.
Right.
And that's one of the things that is very energizing about memoir, is this kind of slide between the self at different stages of a life. And to some degree, that's a work of memory, and to some degree, it's a work of imagination and of invention. And therefore, the speaker in memoir is a creation too.
Yeah. One of my absolute favorite books is A Different Person, James Merrill's memoir, and I guess a lot of times people think that poets aren't good prose writers. I think there's this sort of weird thing, but I mean, it's one of the best pieces of prose and also memoir that I can think of, and I think he really does that thing you're talking about, allowing that, I guess it was about 40 years gap between the time he's talking about and the time he's writing, to where he really gets to invent who he was.
This is a brilliantly structured book because there are chapters that narrate the writer's life in his 20s, alternated with italicized sections that comment, that look back at or spin out a metaphor or an ancillary tale. Yeah. So you feel as if there are two speakers in that book who are looking at each other across time.
I guess this is a sort of footnote to this, but Frost had an aphorism: I doesn't always mean me. And that's true in writing, I think.
I'd like to also just talk to the three of you about your practice in prose, which you've just brought up, but more in terms of an engagement with language. You practice different kinds of prose, be it journalism or writing memoirs or critical writing. And I wonder how that might fit with the poetry that you write. Is it more of a counterbalance, or is it a kind of similar obsession in a different way? In terms of working through in writing your thoughts, how might those two, poetry writing and prose writing, work?
One thing, not to strike an unseemly note of envy here, but when I write prose, I find it very reassuring, because once you start a piece of prose, I find you can go to the desk for 2 or 3 hours a day, however long you have, and make progress. Some days, all writers pray in projects like this, give us this day our daily paragraph. But there, your prayer really is answered in a quotidian way, whereas with a poem, I find that oftentimes it's just being as attentive and passive and as receptive as possible. And one learns, I think, writing poems, that you really can't take a draft by the neck and say, you know, damn it, grow up and be a poem. You've got to let it develop organically and at its own pace. And in that sense, moving from poetry to prose is very comforting. There's a sense of achievement at the end of every day.
And the poet always faces the horror of starting over and starting over and starting over, right? Will there be another poem?
Yeah.
And what will I do this time? Whereas with the prose project, you could pick up a thread and have that reassuring quality of continuity.
How about your work as a journalist with The New Yorker, Dana?
Well, I think that this is sort of different from what Tim and Mark are saying, because I find sometimes there are things that people I interview or things I see when reporting that can't go into a piece, not just because there's not room for them, but because they can't. They came from outer space. They can't go into a piece and have it make any sense. And sometimes I get poems right out of my reporting notebooks, and that it's nice to be to be able to feel like I'm sort of, you know, this omnivore and composting everything, and you know, I feel like a back to the lander with my experiences, because everything will get used. I think it, you know, writing prose, I do completely agree that it's very reassuring to have I think this is somebody else described it this way, I can't remember who, but maybe John Updike, the shore of actual experience or the text that you're referring to when you're writing critically, you know, the one hand touching that while you explore with the other hand, whereas writing poems you are at see most of the time. It is reassuring, and it's also good for me in my case to have the tug of knowing that somebody's waiting for it, and whereas I don't think I'm not getting angry phone calls from poetry editors saying demanding to know when I'm filing my 200 words.
One can only hope we live in a world like that.
It might be helpful if we did. Yeah, for me. It might be helpful.
In service of time, I'd like to open up the floor to questions. We have a microphone that can go around because we're recording this. So, over there, right over there.
This is a question for Mark Doty. For many years, you've been a wonderful, truly wonderful element in the Dodge Poetry Festival every 2 years when my wife and I have seen you. I know you don't run it, but you seem to be a key part of it. Do you think there's any chance in the off years to come to L.A. someday, perhaps to this building?
it's an amazing festival. If you've never done this, if you ever have the opportunity, it's really remarkable. It's a four-day poetry festival in western New Jersey, out near the Delaware Water Gap. It takes place outdoors. There is a tent which seats 3,000 or 4,000 people, and a remarkable crew of poets show up every other year. There is no experience comparable to having 4,000 people leaning into a poem or laughing. It's as you can feel it physically. I think it is such an incredible labor of love for its organizers that I can't imagine them being able to do it every year. I don't think they could stand it. They would die. So what needs to happen are replications, you know, like committed souls who want to do something like that, perhaps with the good counsel of the Dodge Foundation. Oh.
Another question, right here.
Oh, well, it's not particular to any poet, but to all poets. It's generally said that the poetry is nothing but 99% perspiration. For example, look at the person, a man or a woman, there's a smile on her lips and there are tears in her eyes. So, politely, how you enter that type of emotion or ego into the poetry? On one side, the modern poet faces a lot of pressure, different new symbols and language and diction and all these sorts of. So did you feel any sort of moment on those occasions when you express or when the poem is in production?
So I think it's more of a question of writing under pressure and
writing in states of heightened feeling. So, uh-huh. Well, yes. Yes. And, you know, very few people are compelled to write a poem in a state of unbridled joy. You know, when we're filled with delight, you know, we like to go for a walk, or we like to tell somebody we're full of delight, or we like to do all kinds of things besides write a poem. And many, many people who do not otherwise consider themselves poets turn to this art in times of desolation. It's simply human to want to turn towards heightened speech as a way to make some kind of container for what you feel, to give shape to it, to get the words outside of yourselves, to be able to look at your feeling or give it to someone else. Absolutely. And you can see the concomitant challenge, which is the more you are feeling as you write, the harder it gets to stand back from that language and craft something which can help the reader to feel. The very definition of sentimentality is when the writer feels more than the reader does, right? So what we have to, there's this odd alchemy that goes on when you're writing out of strong feeling, that you're giving shape to feeling, but you're also gradually getting yourself out of the way in order to create an experience for somebody else. And that's the real paradox of writing. And I think the only way that I believe that writing is actually therapeutic is that you start forgetting about yourself while you're worrying about your line breaks.
Right down here.
This is a question for Mark Doty. I'm wondering, your memoir, Heaven's Coast, is sort of a long, extended prose poem, and I wondered, when you wrote it, did you have it a structure in mind, or did it evolve, or did it have a narrative arc? Because it's so iconic, really, for how you... It has a structure, but it doesn't, and I wondered, given all this talk of poetry, was writing it similar to writing your poetry, or was it something entirely different?
I wrote the book to stay alive. Really, this was my first memoir, and it was written. It was begun very soon after the death of my partner in 1994. And I couldn't write poetry at that time, but I desperately needed to make something in that state of heightened feeling. I was cracked open by grief, and I found the only thing I could do was to simply try to write sentences to describe what it was like to be walking around in the world in this new state of mind. So I started out just simply making a chronicle of grieving, and I wrote what I thought was an essay, and then I started another one. And by about the third essay, I thought, no, these are chapters, and I'm going to make a book which observes grief. And that's truly the only the structural principle of that book, is that I wanted to record a year of grieving. And I thought of it in the way that, you know, within Jewish families, a year after a loss, people gather and the headstone is unveiled. And so the name of the person who's been lost is now written in the world. And I thought, while he didn't have a gravestone, his ashes were scattered, and in some way my book would be a way of writing his name in the world, or our names together. Yeah. So I was sort of teaching myself to write prose at the same time, and I loved that I could throw everything in the way that in poems you're always throwing everything out, you know, but in prose I could put in and I could put in. And of course, this meant I made a huge mess. And there was a great work of paring back and trying to give shape to the book after the fact.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. One more question. Right down here. Wait. Let's get the microphone down for you so it can be recorded. Thanks.
Somebody somewhere, an old writer said that the poets are the unspoken or unheralded legislators of the world.
Shelley.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but isn't it that also, on the other hand, poetry should also be a mouthpiece, you know, a way of a channel where the people who cannot speak out can speak? And is it, what can you say about what recently was a remark and not quite welcome remark, especially in our country, about that fellow who kind of stated sort of a fact about the American writer not winning the Nobel Prize for several years, and that we are kind of self-conscious and engrossed with things of our own affairs, and we have not looked broadly enough. What can you say about it, and what can you suggest to a kind of struggling writer to succeed?
Very good question.
Yeah, nice final question.
Dana has a lot to say about it.
I think, if I remember right, the main point of that comment was that America is so isolated from the rest of the world, and that is why American writers don't win Nobel Prizes for literature, or haven't for some time. But it sounds to me that what you're asking is about poetry as a place for the voiceless to find a voice. That seems, I mean, I don't really know what motivated the comment of the I think it was a Nobel Prize committee member, but I do think that it is free. Anyone can write a poem. It does not require complex or expensive investments in technology. I mean, a lot of poets write at least one draft by hand. I mean, I do. I don't know. We didn't talk about materials and process at all, but I don't know if Mark and Tim do. So I think there is the opportunity for poetry to be written by anybody. And a lot of people would argue that some of the ways of professionalizing poetry or making it expensive to be a poet are actually to the detriment of poetry. So I think that there's a large argument for sort of radical innocence in writing poems. And then, I don't know, this is to be very 2008, you know, anyone can publish themselves now too, because the internet is how most people seem to be reading and more. So I think that now is probably the best time to be for the voiceless to be heard in that way. But gaining an audience is nearly impossible for anyone who's writing poems, so it's probably not the best medium if you want to reach a large group of people.
One of the judges for the National Book Award this year was interviewed by a journalist. This is somebody who had just read, 4/5 of the poetry books published in America this year or last year. And she said that she realized through this reading that American poets are no longer afraid of writing political poetry. And that was a really interesting thing to say, because for quite a long time we've had a sense that they're, there was a conservative aesthetic camp, and then there were committed social poets, and that these were two different things. It's not true anymore. I think that environmental crisis, the horrors of the last 8 years, the war, have really provoked a sense of necessity among many American poets for a poetry that is both doing the work of witness and also and speaking of difficult circumstances, and is also artfully built. So this is a very exciting thing, and I feel encouraged by it.
Well, I think that's a terrific note to end the reading on. Thanks to all of you for coming. Please do buy our readers' books and get them signed outside. Yeah. And come to the next Aloud reading. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.